Thank you for listening to this archive of Teaching American History's Saturday webinar on February 1st, 2020. Today's American Minds webinar was about William Jennings Bryan. And for this discussion, we were joined by moderator Dr. Chris Burkett and panelists Dr. John Moser and Dr. Jason Stevens, all of whom are on faculty together at Ashland University. Thanks again for joining us. And make sure to share this archive with friends on social media and subscribe to our podcast for automatic updates every month. Thanks so much.
Well, welcome everybody to another TeachingAmericanHistory.org Saturday webinar sponsored by the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University. TAH.org is the leading online resource for the documents-based study of American history, government, and civics for teachers, students, and citizens. I'm Chris Burkett. Teach here at Ashland University, and in case you're joining us for the first time, the theme of our webinar series this year is American Minds, and the point is to pull together some thoughtful scholars, have a conversation about important persons in U.S. history who either influenced or somehow reflected this thing we call the American mind, riffing off of a term that Thomas Jefferson used in one of his letters. As always, we encourage you to join us in this conversation by submitting questions in the chat box, and we will try to get as many as possible. Let me just say to our participants, our scholars today, if you see a question in the chat box, please feel free to jump right in and answer it if you're so inclined. And if you're submitting a question, please make sure that you submit it to all participants and not just me privately so that everybody can see your question. In the next week, you'll receive a link in an email by which to request a certificate of participation, as well as a link to the archived video and audio from today's program. As always, we try to draw our conversations from documents that you can access and find at our document collection at TAH.org, and those are recommended by our scholars. Today, we're discussing William Jennings Bryan, and to help us today think through this important person, I'm happy to introduce my friends and colleagues here at Ashland University, John Moser and Jason Stevens. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
Morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I can think of few more pleasant things to do than to have a good conversation with friends on a Saturday morning about important people and ideas. So glad you took the time to do it. So I usually start by throwing some broad thoughts out there, and you guys then take it away and talk about whatever you want to talk about. But maybe a general question about Bryan. We've included him in this list of great American minds, and yet you think about his political career. Here's a guy who lost three presidential elections, was leader, so to speak, of the populist movement, a political movement that sort of stalled out. He was essentially a two-term congressman from Nebraska, and he's known as the Great Commoner, which is not exactly the sexiest name, right? Compared to the Great Emancipator and things like this, the Great Commoner. So I just thought maybe both of you could say a few words about why you think Bryan is worthy of study. Why is he worthy of being included in a series on great American minds? Any thoughts to get us started along these lines?
I can start off and say maybe a little bit about that. You're right. His name, the Great Commoner, in comparison to the Great Emancipator and the Great Compromiser, doesn't sound nearly as interesting. But I would claim that Bryan is actually a really interesting figure. He's interesting in part because of the arguments that he's making against imperialism at the end of the 1800s, at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. The arguments that he makes, especially on imperialism, are not popular ones, right? It's sort of the losing argument of the time, but I think he makes the better argument. And I think actually, that is, as time has gone on, we understand that's Bryan and the anti-imperialists of that time were making the better argument, to the extent that their argument was more in line with the American founding.
Interesting.
And, you know, the economic argument, that's another issue where Brian is, again, on the losing side, at least at the time. And, you know, losing two elections to William McKinley on his platform of McKinley's platform of tariffs and the gold standard. And I mean, maybe we can have a debate about that. But I think that that Brian is actually, you know, making some interesting and compelling arguments here. But although at the time may not have been pretty popular, right, I have a lot of weight to them.
Very interesting. John, any thoughts on that or want to add anything?
This is a guy who is deeply and closely involved with just about every major development of national importance from the 1890s through the early 1920s. So it just by studying Brian, you can learn a lot about the history of this period. Secondly, he is so hard to pin down. The word populist, I think, fairly applies. I hear him sometimes called a progressive. I don't know about that, although he certainly did associate himself with certain causes that might be called progressive. At the same time, he's deeply moralistic. I see there's already a question here about that, about the, sort of his evangelical approach.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of, I mean, he may be the first American fundamentalist to really throw himself into public life in a major way. So obviously, a fundamentalist Protestant, fundamentalist evangelical Protestantism
mm-hmm.
informs everything that he talks about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. By the way, are you guys getting any feedback? I'm hearing a lot of feedback. Is it just me?
If I mute my mic when I'm not speaking, then it seems to
okay.
be. And I'm doing it.
Okay. Now. All right, good. Well, apologize to all for any feedback that you're hearing. But John, on that point, and Jason, so it is interesting you brought up what, you know, the question whether he's a progressive or a populist, because he spans both eras, right, so to speak. And how influential was he in the sort of in putting together what comes to be known as the populist movement? Can we talk a little bit about the populist movement? Because that's a term that's become very popular again today, right? Populism.
Mm.
So what was populism? How would you characterize it as it sort of developed at this time? And what was Brian's role in making this a kind of coherent movement of sorts? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Okay. I'll take a stab at a definition.
I know it's tough to define these things sometimes.
Right, right. It is a political ideology that asserts the moral superiority of the ordinary person, although in Brian's day, I think it's more appropriate to say the moral superiority of those who work with their hands. Because today's kind of, you know, when I think of the kind of populism that's used by President Trump, there's some aspect of that, but a lot of his supporters are, you know, we would consider them white collar types who do not work with their hands. So, but certainly at this period, we're talking about those who do engage in physical labor.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, today's populism doesn't seem to be an anti-wealth populism. Is it too simple to say that there's a lot of that in the original?
Oh yeah, no doubt. And of course, these repeated references to Jackson, right? Jackson is usually mm-hmm. is the original populist. Although Jackson himself was extremely wealthy, Brian never was.
Yeah, and John, just listening to you describe Brian's understanding of populism, it reminded me of what he says in the Cross of Gold speech, several paragraphs in, where he's talking about the businessman, and Brian is arguing that, right, the man who works with his hands, the farmer, right, he's just as much a businessman as sort of the white-collar rich man, when he says, quote, "We say to you that you have made the definition of a businessman too limited in its application. The man who is employed for wages is as much a businessman as his employer. The attorney in a country town is as much a businessman as the corporation council in a great metropolis. The merchant at the crossroads store is as much a businessman as the merchant of New York. The farmer who goes forth in the morning and toils all day, who begins in spring and toils all summer, and who, by the application of brain and muscle to the natural resources of the country, creates wealth, is as much a businessman as the man who goes upon the board of trade and bets upon the price of grain, so on and so forth. Right? Yeah,
that's
he has the Brian has the support of the Populist Party in the election of 1896, and then again in 1900, although not to the same extent that he had in 1896, I believe. So he is their candidate, mostly on this issue of bimetallism that he runs on in the 1896 campaign. He lays it out here in this cross of gold, which I think most of us are probably familiar with, or pretty familiar with. There are attacks on the wealthy, right, throughout this speech, and he brings in not only Jackson but also Lincoln and Jefferson, right, to defend those positions, whether or not those are whether or not his use of those authorities is accurate, maybe is another debate.
Yeah. I don't think you can understand Bryan and other populists without understanding the labor theory of value, the notion that originally with John Locke, the idea that all value comes to anything by virtue of the labor that is applied to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when we're talking about the world of corporate capitalism of the late 19th century, you saw lots of wealth being created and ending up in the hands of those who did not engage in what is traditionally thought of as labor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe the labor theory of value, central to Karl Marx also, then you have to say something really bad is going on and it has to be fixed.
Mm.
Yeah, so this is the era of, when the term unearned income becomes a really, negative term, right? So unearned income versus income or wealth is created through labor. And again, that's this leads me back to this sort of question I often get when I teach the progressive era course for MAG, which I'm teaching right now, right? What is Bryan? I mean, because some of the language and some of his motives seem very similar to the language and motives of people we think of later as progressives, right? They also have this understanding of the labor theory of value, John, right, and a critique of unearned wealth. But it seems like they propose different ways, perhaps, to deal with that. I'm not sure. Please go right ahead.
Mm-hmm.
John, did you want to jump in? Or somebody wanted to jump in.
The big difference between Bryan and the progressives, which is why I hesitate to call him a progressive, even, as I said before, even though he embraced things that are considered progressive, is he's always looking backward. The country has gone astray. There's something deeply conservative about Bryan's argument, certainly when it comes to the Philippines, right? He refers more to the Declaration of Independence than anything else. We're betraying our nation's founding principles. But he also kind of does a cross of gold speech by suggesting that the old, we need to get back to the old republic. And something else that was the hallmark of the populists was the notion that we needed a handful of big reforms, right? 1896, free silver is the big one. And then the system which has gone askew will get knocked back into place and everything will be fine. Right? People thought that about the Sherman Antitrust Act. Okay, trade. Bam, right. Well, that'll be taken care of. And we'll be back to this Jeffersonian, Jacksonian republic of producers again. Progressives never... By the way, today we are so quick to associate the populists and the progressives, but the progressives, many progressives loathed the populists. Certainly Republican progressives did. Teddy Roosevelt suggested hanging them. I mean, was probably speaking in mm-hmm. jest or acting as you know, just bloviating as Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. But he had nothing but contempt for the Posse because mm-hmm. he saw them as reactionaries.
Oh, okay.
Not people who, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, John. I didn't mean to cut off your thought there. But I was wondering if because they were reactionaries, because they weren't also, they tended not to be sort of statist. Progressives tended to turn to the state and in a new sort of regulatory capacity that some progressives weren't willing to. I mean, again, how do we fix the problems? Silver standard and maybe some regulation of railroad rates, perhaps, and things like that. But I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll just say on that question that if the question is Bryan a populist or not, or where does he sort of fit in? I think reading his speeches, some of them seem like this guy fits in well with the other progressives. I read the Cross of Gold speech and his attacks on special interests, on the wealthy. When he says there are those who believe that if you will only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperity will leak through of those below. The democratic idea, however, has been that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up through every class which rests upon them. I mean, that could have come out of any, you know, Theodore Roosevelt speech in the early 20th century. In some ways, especially economically, I see Bryan as a progressive. But then there are other issues on imperialism, for example, where he's very anti-progressive. I mean, that is to say, he's a member of the anti-imperialist league. But so were a lot of progressives: John Dewey, Jane Addams, other very famous progressives of this period. Right? Did not all agree on every issue, and you know, actually split on the issue of imperialism. And so I would say I think of Bryan as a progressive, but it sort of depends on the issue. The interesting thing is that he loses two elections to William McKinley, right? Who I think is right. There's no doubt that McKinley is sort of the embodiment of the progressive era of this age. And Bryan is right, the guy the Democrats turned to after abandoning Cleveland following the panic of what is 1893, which leads into these economic debates. So it sort of depends what the issue is that you're talking about, whether or not Bryan's a progressive or not.
Yeah.
The issue of free silver seems to me a typical populist approach to a problem. And it's interesting how few of the backers of silver find their way into the progressive movement. If we think about Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, they were both gold standard guys. The progressive approach to the problem of money was Federal Reserve. Okay, what's the difference between those two options? Free silver, it's simple. We just monetize silver. We tie it to gold in a specific ratio, and we increase the money supply as a result. And then let things go. Mm-hmm. Compare that to the Federal Reserve. We need a group of experts to decide how large the money supply is supposed to is. How much money we want in circulation, and then to make decisions to put that into practice. Populists. In fact, populists did not like the Federal Reserve from the start, because this is shadowy figures, many of which were hated bankers, right, who were basically controlling our money supply. As opposed, I mean, for populists, there was no social problem that ordinary people couldn't understand and fix themselves through simple remedies. Mm-hmm. That's nonsense. The problems of modern society are complicated. Ordinary people might understand at a gut level that something is wrong, but they don't know what to do. So we have to have experts who can go in and keep their fingers. We need to build machinery and have smart people operating the machinery. Mm-hmm. It's not a populist way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. And Bryan is a member of Wilson's cabinet when the Federal Reserve System is created.
Yeah, yeah. And that's mostly because of the dynamics of the Democratic Party at the time. Mm-hmm. In 1912, even Brian says, okay, I'm done running for president. That was three times is enough. But each time, the Democratic Party was deeply divided. There were a huge anti-Brian forces in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't, they just weren't big enough to stop him in 1896 and 1900 and 19. Mm-hmm. They were able to stop him in 1904, which mm-hmm. is why Alvin Parker, who's a conservative Wall Street type, mm-hmm. and hated, was the nominee in 1904. Mm-hmm. But in 1912, Wilson never much cared for Bryan, but he understood that if he wants the nomination, he's got to make nice with Bryan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And offering him the Secretary of State position was the seal.
Did Wilson care much for anybody? Never mind. Don't answer that. Other than himself, I shouldn't say that. But I do. It would be interesting at some point to come back and talk about his relationship with Brian a little more. We've got these are great thoughts, and we've got a number of really good questions coming in. So I'm just going to backtrack a little bit here. But Cindy asked about the extent to which the populist movement was a reaction to monopolies and monopolists. Is that an accurate description of some of the things they were reacting to? And I noticed you used the term reacting to, right? That's another difference, I think, between populists and progressives. But what was their solution to monopolies? Any?
Yeah.
Or was that an issue?
You know, this was an idea that divided the progressives, too. Is the best way to deal with quote-unquote monopolies or the trusts or big business, is it to break them up? Populists loved that idea. And that held on in a certain kind of progressivism. I mean, that was Robert La Follette's preferred way of dealing with things. It was Louis D. Brandeis's way of dealing with it. And he was a big influence on Wilson. Of course, Wilson didn't really follow through with that so much. On the other hand, the other approach was to say big business combinations are inevitable. In a way, they're desirable because they're more efficient. Mm-hmm. However, they have to be regulated in the public interest. Brian was never all that comfortable with that with that way of
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, certainly the populists were reacting against. What they saw was the decline of the old republic of small producers. These massive, massive conglomerates and the railroads, the beasts that were closest to them. Maybe at some point we talk about Wizard of Oz, but
that's a great point. Yeah. So on this point, by the way, again, I got a number of really good questions, and I'm going to skip a few and track and circle back to them to sort of stay on the same theme. Greg asks, is the technological revolution of the 20th century responsible for the shift from the yeoman farmer ideal of Bryan's populism and the populism of today? Is anti-elitism the bridge between the two and a function of lifestyle rather than wealth today? Greg's looking for the similarities here. Thoughts on that? That's a really good question.
It's a really good question. I don't know if I have a good answer to it.
I'm going to take a stab at it.
All right.
This fits in with Brian's religiosity. The popular press of the time loved to point to examples of rich people behaving badly. And of course, that wasn't hard to find, right? Lavish sums being spent on parties, on illicit love affairs. On young wastrel heirs to fortunes behaving in sinful ways. There was this association of the new the new industrial order with association of this with sin, and in fact, often these Midwestern and Western farmers, and I think this helps us to explain why one of the questions I saw was about why why Brian didn't do better in the cities.
Yes, yeah.
There was always a strain of populist thought that looked down on on for certainly immigrants and those who lived in the tenements. Okay, so if you're Brian, you make an occasional nod in their direction by saying we support labor unions, but culturally they were so different. They didn't speak, they didn't speak our language. They were Catholics or Jews rather than Protestants. They ate weird food. They lived in conditions that we consider to be unhygienic. The cities were an alien creature for populists, and they really couldn't hide that, even with all their gestures in support of union labor. I hope I answered the actual question there. It's
all over. Well, that was very thoughtful. I mean, because again, the populism I think of as a mostly Midwestern movement. I mean, right? And Brian, no accident, is from Nebraska, so seems like the common view or idea that motivates populists at the time was the problems we're dealing with are sort of the spillover from East Coast problems, the problems of Eastern culture, Eastern urbanization, Eastern industrialization. And so I can see that there's a natural sort of distrust of the overpopulated industrial and economic centers of the East.
And let's not forget Prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
Brian is an ardent dry, even though he doesn't really put it at the center of his campaign. He certainly was a supporter of either strong restrictions on liquor or play well with
him. I was going to say he just lost my respect. He just lost my vote. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. In the same vein, Brian is one of the first guys to sort of go out on the campaign trail to win votes, to talk to voters, to do sort of the modern campaigning that we were so used to today, which just simply wasn't the norm back then, right? William McKinley and his famous front porch campaign, right? He's sitting on his front porch at his home in Canton, Ohio, and the people are just coming to him. Brian is actually going out to the people.
Right on that point.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Fascinating things about how Brian changes the nature of campaigning. Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson are out there traveling all over the place. It costs a whole lot more to conduct a political campaign where you're traveling around talking to the people. Staying home on the front porch like McKinley did, that doesn't cost much at all. So one of the big unintended consequences of this is the Democrats become more dependent on donations. So political, money in politics, even though the populists rail against it and later the progressives do, they're dependent on it because they can't carry out this way of bringing their message directly to the people any way.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think you already touched on Shailen's point, right? Shailen's question about Brian's lack of support, urban support, right, in campaigns. And John had asked the question about the campaigns as well, our friend John Giltner. So he mentions McKinley was able to give several speeches, right, per day on a wide range of issues. But Brian gave the same speech multiple times a day during his whistle stop tour. So that mode of campaigning hurt Brian somehow, you think? I mean, John asked specifically if he might have won in 1896 if he had run a different campaign. But
Well, I do know that I think it's unfair to criticize Brian for using the same speech over and over and over again. Again, that's sort of how modern campaigns today are conducted. But Brian used that to great effect. Brian used that to great effect. He was known as the great commoner, but this man was really, really a great orator. The way he could write a speech and then deliver that speech. I mean, the Cross of Gold is sort of the perfect embodiment of that. And he had a reputation for that. People knew that, when Brian was going to speak, you were going to hear something great. You were going to hear a great speech. I mean, you know, just the last lines of the Cross of Gold speech. You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. I mean, this speech just electrifies the 1896 Democratic National Convention, which I think was in Chicago. And nobody thought that, you know, that Bryan was, you know, going to be the candidate, except maybe Bryan. And he sort of, I mean, as a result of this speech, really ends up, it turns into an eventual landslide for him. I think he's elected on like the fifth ballot or something, but that was because of this speech. Yeah. He's the candidate because of this speech.
Yeah,
right? That's not something sort of just a nobody could do. It takes a great order to do something like that. Sorry, go ahead.
Great point, Jason. It reminds me again, because of the question I started with, the way at the beginning, why do we, you know, why is this guy worth studying? You remind me that he did make the gold and silver standard a central, if not the central issue of the election, right, in 1896, yeah. And in part because of the speech. So, I mean, even McKinley had to rethink his position on. So he is really setting, the tone for the election in a certain sense, even though, of course, he ends up losing. I mean, that's quite an accomplishment politically. So, yeah, these are very good points. And can we just say something? I've got another couple of good questions here to turn to, but just a little bit of clarification, if you don't mind, on the silver standard issue. Mm-hmm. So I have students ask me all the time, why the silver standard? Why were they pushing so much for the silver standard? My understanding is that Bryan and other populists thought that the fact that we were on the single standard, the gold standard, the wealth of the country, control of the wealth of the country, essentially had been cornered by the wealthiest bankers and owners of corporations, again, back east, right? John, am I understanding this correct? Opening the silver standard up would allow more people, especially in the Midwest, to have some?
Yeah, that was a big part of it. I mean, more fundamentally, because the dollar was tied to gold and only to gold, the amount of gold in the world had not changed that much. It would, by the way. We could talk maybe in a little while about why the gold standard, why this whole silver issue vanished very quickly. But money was tight, right? There was not much. The money in circulation was pretty strictly limited by the amount of gold. And the thought was, and really, as a result, the 1890s were kind of a period of depression in the United States. And this led to the cry for monetizing silver, because it actually had been monetized at one point. In 1877, it was the tie between gold and silver was severed, and only gold was going to be the standard. And so the populace looked back and talked about the crime of 1877 as silver was in circulation at one point, but now it isn't. So by adding silver, there was a whole lot of America had a whole lot of silver, and there were silver strikes all through the West. You could really have an increase in the amount of money that was out there. In other words, inflation. Who likes inflation? Well, you like inflation if you're in debt, because you borrowed money that had a certain value, and you're paying back in less valuable dollars. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't like it? Well, the people who lend money. So the bank,
yeah.
I thought that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Also those who were on a fixed income, right? Mm-hmm. The dollar amount that they got did not change. Then they were getting money that was worth, that was worth less. By the way, some of the biggest supporters of silver standards were silver miners in the West. So you had, it's wrong to say that this is big business versus the farmer, because there were a lot of big businesses that were engaged in silver mining who saw a lot of benefit in seeing monetized silver.
Oh, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that makes perfect sense now. So the more high-minded arguments I've read, high-minded, say, well, this will help to sort of stabilize the economy, because as you mentioned, there's been a series of recessions, right, in the last couple of decades. But yeah, the interest part of it is always the fascinating part, right? Whose interest is it? to half silver. So very thoughtful. Thank you, John. And Christopher asked earlier, if I can find it really quick. So Brian was the great commoner. Many populist ideas appeal to the common man. Why did the party and their ideas have trouble gaining traction and winning national elections? And I'm going to add on to that my own question. Why were the progressives more successful in this than Brian and the populists? Any thoughts on that? Do we know?
Yeah, no. I'll jump in and say that. Well, I mean, during this period, in fact, for most of American history, right, third parties are frankly not very popular, right, in American elections for several reasons. Now, the progressives, as you know, Chris, do slightly better, but only slightly, right? I mean, you know, 1912 is sort of the prime example of that, where where Wilson, the Democrat, wins, but the Republicans, because they split the vote between Taft and TR, the progressive candidate, right, Wilson ends up winning. But TR, the progressive, comes in, beats Taft, comes in second, right? So that's about the extent of the victory for the progressives, at least in terms of, right, at least electoral.
Sure.
But what has to happen is, right, that those third parties have to find a candidate, in one of the two major parties that they can back, and at least they can make certain compromises. And this was something I was working with the convention, right? I mean, the populists would walk out of the DNC if the candidate who was selected wasn't to their liking. I mean, that was routine, and actually, it's not just the populists, but right, you see that sort of throughout American history during the split in the Democratic Party in 1860, for example. Yeah, the progressives are slightly more popular than the populists, but only slightly.
Yeah. Historians talk about, but 1896 is the high water mark for populism, but it's also the death of it because it worked into the Democratic. In fact, some lead populists at the time said, we should not endorse Brian, even though he's with us on this one big issue. But if we do this, we're going to end up just becoming an adjunct to the Democratic Party. And that's what happened. But if you look at the results of the election of 1896, Brian did, I mean, obviously he lost, but he did pretty well for a loser.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, of course, knows Democrats got the South. That was a given. But really, almost all of the largely agrarian states of the Midwest and West went for Brian also.
Mm-hmm.
So take that to the question of why progressivism did better. To the extent that progressives were willing to endorse certain things that populists had also liked, they could hold on to the farm vote. But at the same time, who are the progressives? Well, you know, they're not farmers. They're middle class urbanites.
Mm.
And so progressives could make inroads in those urbanized states.
That's a great point.
That the populists never had a chance with.
Yeah, that's great, John. That makes a lot of sense. And what you were saying and what Jason was saying made me think perhaps also, I guess one of you mentioned the Democratic Party was just not ready to fully embrace Brian, right? Mm-hmm. And it reminded me that progressives or progressivism seemed to have its most success when it operated from within the Republican Party, right? So most of the people who consider themselves or we think of as early progressives were really Republicans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they had found a home within a party that lent a certain degree of popularity, I'm sure, to it, right? Although, again, I know there are disagreements within the Republican Party about this.
Mm-hmm.
But it raises another question. I'm just going to take it slightly off topic, if you don't mind. It's related. So if the Democratic Party wasn't fully ready for Brian, to embrace Brian in some ways, maybe that's an unfair way to put it, what happens to the Democrats over the next decade so that by 1912 they're ready to accept somebody like Woodrow Wilson, who to me seems much more radical in some ways than Brian was. Again, there's that kind of conservatism to Brian. that would make me think he's, you know, he's got a home in a Democratic Party, given their political traditions. It's always sort of stumped me that Wilson gets the support of the Democratic Party.
That's a great question. And I would answer that by saying that if you are judging Wilson by what he actually did in office, that he was more radical in office than he was on the campaign trail in 1912. Now, everyone understood him to be a progressive, which is why Bryan was willing to get behind him. Bryan did not want another Alton Parker being nominated. Mm-hmm. And there were, I mean, I've been really doing a lot of work on the 1912 election lately. And the fight for the Democratic nomination was really fascinating, because you had Wilson looked like the most, farthest left. I don't know if that's a really appropriate way to put it, but he was certainly more radical than, say, Oscar Underwood of Alabama, Harmon Judson, the governor of Ohio, Champ Clark, who was Speaker of the House. He was the favorite going in. These guys were very traditional Jeffersonian Democrats who the tariff was their big issue. But in other words, they reached back to the tradition of Democrats in the Gilded Age. And Wilson, on the other hand, embraced more progressive ideas. Bryan was attracted to him for that reason. But if you look at Wilson's rhetoric, he talks about Burke. He talks about the need for change only to the extent that change was necessary. And the fear, certainly among even more conservative Democrats, was that, because by the time the Democratic Convention rolled around, everyone knew that Teddy Roosevelt was in the race. It was clear, unless they did something to screw it up, the Democrats were going to win in 1912. This was their biggest opportunity in a long time.
But no matter who was the candidate, right?
What's that?
No matter who was the candidate.
Well, the fear was one way to mess it up would be to nominate somebody who is perceived as conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Then progressives in the Democratic Party might bolt and go to Roosevelt. That was regarded as the one. So you had even conservative Democrats saying, mm-hmm. if we want the White House and the patronage that goes with it, we better suck it up and embrace this guy, even if we don't like his, even if there are things about him that we're not sure about. Wilson also was, again, you have to look at Wilson in 1912 versus what we know about what he did. At the state level, Wilson was fairly progressive. But, you know, Democrats could say, sure, at the state level, you could do lots of things. We just don't want federal government doing it. Wilson, like FDR was in 1932, Wilson was kind of vague about what he actually intended to do in office.
Mm-hmm.
Compare that to Teddy Roosevelt. Everyone in the world knew what Teddy Roosevelt stood for on every, because, you know, he didn't shut up.
That's true.
This. And so that really worked to Wilson's benefit. I think there were Democrats, just as there were Democrats in the 1930s who supported Roosevelt in 32 and said, well, that's the New Deal wasn't what I signed up for.
Yeah.
There were Democrats in after 1912 who said, yeah, Wilson was, we didn't expect this from Wilson.
If I could just piggyback on that for a minute, because, John, you mentioned earlier a really great point about Bryan that I hadn't thought of, that Bryan, unlike the progressive, Bryan was always looking backwards, right? Talking about the past. That was not Wilson, right? Wilson was, right, and by his own admission, right, was always looking forward. That's sort of what he said, right? That's in the nature of what it means to be a progressive. We think of the future as the more glorious time in comparison to which the present and the past is nothing. Progressives are always forward looking instead of those reactionaries or those more conservative Democrats who are always thinking of the past, which is why, right, Bryan is constantly invoking, right, 1776 in many of his speeches and And Wilson is looking to move us beyond the principles of 1776. And that has consequences for the 1912 election and then Wilson's presidency, because Bryan, as you mentioned, John, serves as Secretary of State, but then resigns in protest on June 9th of 1915 over Wilson's direction that he's taking the country in World War I, where it looks like Wilson is now taking the nation down the path of a war following the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. As long as Wilson was calling for the United States to be neutral in as well as action, Bryan is on board. It's when Wilson starts taking the nation down the route of, well, you know, for the advancement of civilization and the development of man, maybe the United States needs to get involved in this contest. It's there that there's a break between the Wilson and the progressives and Bryan and the more conservative Democrats. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So we've got, you know, his letter to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, right, and these sorts of things. So Bryan's foreign policy is something I know virtually nothing about, interestingly enough. So I know he was split. What was it specifically he split with Wilson over again?
Response to the Lusitania.
Wilson's response to the Lusitania.
Yeah.
So Wilson's letter to the Germans, Bryan thought that was too aggressive, that was going to draw us out of neutrality into a stance of, okay, very interesting.
He had also, Bryan had said soon after the war started, some leading bankers of the United States, because it was common that if foreign bonds were going to be offered in the United States for sale, that you would get the approval of the State Department first. And several banking houses said, well, we want British and French bonds to be marketed in the United States, which means, of course, extending loans to those countries. And Bryan strongly said, no, we don't do this. He said, money is the worst of all contrabands because it contributes to everything else, right? If we send money to one side, that's really going to make us unneutral. And that situation stayed in place until after Bryan left. Bryan thought that the United States should treat German violations of neutral rights exactly as it treats British violations, because the British were violating rights, mm-hmm. not in as dramatic a way as sinking ships,
right?
But in stopping and seizing cargoes,
yeah, their embargo of Germany,
right? Yeah, the blockade. So Bryan's position was we ought to protest against both the same ways, ideally. We should stop ship. Almost a return to the Embargo Act. We should not trade with either side. That's going to be the best way to stay neutral. It'll keep our ships out of war zones, and we don't have to worry about it. Well, a lot of America's prosperity at that point. America did very well from World War I. The economy was booming, and had the Wilson administration followed Bryan's advice, the economy would have tanked.
It's fascinating. So
can I say one more thing about
please, yeah, sure.
Bryan as Secretary of State? So Bryan, the arch prohibitionist, upon becoming Secretary of State, he sent an order out to all embassies that they were not to serve any kind of intoxicating beverages at their social functions. So American parties at parties and dinners at American embassies around the world served grape juice. And
you can, so in other words, the most boring parties in the world.
No one wanted to attend parties at American embassies. After.
Yeah, brilliant. Maybe that's what he wanted. Maybe this is perfectly in line with his general approach to foreign policy, right? Being neutral and But that's fascinating. So, you know, we hear the term isolationist tossed around a lot coming out of this era and into up to World War II. And I think people often misapply that term. But was Brian an isolationist, or was he just what do we call a very limited interventionist? And how is that connected somehow to his anti-imperialism?
Yeah,
since we have his anti-imperialism speech, right? So
right. I'll take a stab at that because I think it would be wrong to characterize Brian as an isolationist, and sort of an ostrich-like mentality where America just keeps its head buried in the sand. It doesn't pay attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. I mean, he's Secretary of State, for crying out loud. But he is in favor of neutrality, right? So you read that letter to the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Brian's not talking about isolationism there. He's talking about neutrality, right? Which I take Brian to understand differently from sort of pure isolationism. Neutrality, right? Isolationism has one rule, right? You just sort of you take yourself out of the world situation and act like an ostrich with its head buried in the sand. Whereas neutrality, right? You treat an entry with other nations, but upon an equal basis, right? America has no dog in this fight. In this fight between Germany and Austria-Hungary on one hand, and Great Britain and France on the other, America has no dog in this fight. So we're going to treat each side equally. We're going to trade with both sides. And you know, Brian's protest resignation was based upon the belief that he thought Wilson was actually violating the rules of neutrality. And he's very careful in that report that we read here to go through and, right, here are the rules of neutrality. Here are the rules that a neutral government should follow to be truly neutral, right? And here are the ways that America is trying to live up to those rules. And that may be tied to his thoughts on imperialism, because I got to tell you, when I read this 1900 speech of his, which I guess was the speech he delivered again at the Democratic National Convention, 1900. I had not read this before. I found it absolutely fascinating because I knew Brian was an anti-imperialist, again, a member of the Anti-Imperialist League. But his argument here is not just well-constructed. It's not just, you know, fascinating for sort of its oratory, but the argument itself, taking America sort of back to 1776 and the principles of the Declaration of Independence and explaining why the Declaration of Independence would require us to abandon our imperialistic colonial policy in the Philippines and throughout the world. The American founding, in other words, is against, right, taking the American flag and planting it at Manila and trying to rule over the Philippines, as McKinley and the Republican progressives were attempting to do. At one point in his speech, Brian makes the distinction between imperialism and expansionism, right? He says, right, I'm anti-imperialist, I'm anti-colonialist, but I'm not anti-expansionist, right? And he takes it back to Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase and Texas and, right, you know, America acquiring the Western territories. Brian said, I can be an expansionist without being an imperialist. The thing is, Theodore Roosevelt will make the same argument. He'll say, I'm not an imperialist. I'm just an expansionist. But we're just right. Expanding into the Philippines now.
Yeah, right.
let me add something to that. I contend that Brian is not as much of an anti-imperialist as people think. His position is not, let's pack up and get the hell out of the Philippines. It's, we need to give them a government and then protect the Philippines. In other words, he uses the term protectorate explicitly. By the way, a lot of European countries, big chunks of their empires were not formal possessions, but protectorates, where there was a native government in place. I mean, Cuba was a protectorate of the United States, but where there's a local government in place, on the surface independent, but U.S. forces were stationed there. And U.S. influence, or in the influence of the home country, whatever country we're talking about, over a protectorate was huge. So the Philippines were not. He even uses the term independence.
Mm-hmm.
A protectorate is not a wholly independent country. A protectorate, by the very fact that another country's troops are there, protecting it from harm means that the United States, even under Bryan's plan, would have had huge influence over the Philippines, just as the United States had huge influence over over Cuba, even though it was a nominally independent country.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, John, because Bryan will talk about tying the Monroe Doctrine to the Philippines. Right, he says in this speech, he says, if I could just quote a little bit here on John's point, Bryan says, here's what we should have done in the Philippines. After the Filipinos had aided us in the war against Spain, we could not honorably turn them over to their former masters. Right? So we can't turn them back to Spain. We could not leave them to be the victims of the ambitious designs of European nations. And since we do not desire to make them a part of us or to hold them as subjects, we propose the only alternative, namely to give them independence and guard them against molestation from without. We're going to grant them independence, but then we will protect that independence. I guess the only question then is, okay, their independence and the making of their own constitution and laws, is that something Bryan believed that the Filipinos should be doing themselves or that Americans should be doing for the Filipinos?
Yeah, I mean, this is the time when there seems to be a large range of what it means to be independent, just as there's a large range of what it means for a people to be free, right? I'm thinking mainly of progressive language here, but you know this, Jason, from your studies of McKinley in the Spanish-American War. He claimed to have been in favor of Cuban independence, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe not entirely entire independence all at once, right?
Right.
So this is a time when you can say, I'm in favor of independence, but that doesn't mean immediate and complete independence.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe gradual independence under our watchful tutelage, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea of a protectorate, John, that you're bringing up, I always thought of that relationship as kind of not quite father and son, but maybe really big brother and little brother. And the little brother's got a lot of influence, right? The big brother's got a lot of say. So in Cuba, the reason Cuba's a protectorate is because, as you guys know, the Platt Amendment is there are limits to what you can do without us looking at it first, right? Which is some things we're just going to review and keep an eye on for you, always in the name of your good, right?
Yeah. But I mean, if the Philippines had been a protectorate, it would have been autonomous in the sense that it could make its own legislation affecting it, but certainly its foreign policy and trade policy would have been basically under American control.
Yeah. And again, it's interesting at the time when, you know, they're debating, the sense of debating, what do we do about the Philippines? There are a number of positions that come out of that, right? There are the ones who argue for some form of either protectorate or occupation, but done in the name of American interests. Either military interests, given the expansion of colonial European presence in the Pacific, or economic necessity, right? And some people just argue, well, we need to have a presence in the Philippines because we've established markets in the East.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get the, again, sorry to bring this up, hesitate to bring this in, get this, these sort of over-the-top Albert Beveridge types arguing, no, this is done purely for benevolent reasons, right? Although I don't think that's really what Beveridge said or meant, but we just need to help these people be civilized.
Yeah.
That's not Bryan's argument, right?
Yeah, if I can jump in there, Chris, because that's a great point, because right, Beveridge is talking about we need to uplift the Filipinos, that is, we need to help them out, we need to educate them, we need to bring them Christianity in order to move them along the pathway of true civilization and true humanity. Now, we can't let them vote or determine their own laws or make their own constitutions, but we should educate them, right? So that maybe somewhere down the line, they can be able to do those things for themselves. That's not Bryan. And there's this great line in the 1900 imperialism speech where Bryan says, if we are to govern them, that is the Filipinos, without their consent and give them no voice in determining taxes which they must pay, which of course is what the progressives were were arguing should be done and what actually ended up being done. Brian says, we dare not educate them, lest they learn to read the Declaration of Independence.
That's a great line. That is a great line.
Kind of prophetic, too, when you look at how anti-imperialist movements were really sparked by, you know, anti-colonial movements in the 20th century were sparked by people like Ho Chi Minh, who had traveled to, who studied in Paris and learned the principles of the French Revolution and then applied them back back home.
Yeah.
I could point to Gandhi as the same thing.
That's amazing. That's a great point. by the way, Anne's put in a couple of interesting comments, and there's a question of hers I'd like to get to toward the end. But she brings up the racist aspect of this, right? It's hard to avoid a certain kind of racism in this era, especially when you talk about the question of the Philippines. And do we see traces of that in Brian's anti-imperialism?
I think it's definitely there. Here's the thing about the Philippines. We know they can't be citizens. He doesn't dwell on why, but it's just common sense. They can't be citizens. So the other alternative is they're going to be subjects, and a republic can't have subjects. One is left thinking, well, why couldn't they become, if the Hawaiians could become, well, like, you know, if the Hawaiians could eventually be considered U.S. citizens, why not the Filipinos?
Yeah.
And it's hard to come to any other conclusion except race. And if you look at Brian's attitude toward African Americans, that's not reflected in these documents. It's not like he's one of these Southern Democrats who are for segregation and all that. Brian was simply profoundly uninterested in the plight of blacks. He never encountered, you know, his whole life in Nebraska.
Right.
They simply politically didn't exist to him.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's very fascinating. I hadn't thought about that. In fact, I should have noticed the absence of that in his speeches and his platforms. But by the way, you're bent, on one other just point you made me think of. We in Puerto Rico, right? It's a territory after the Spanish-American War. Why can we annex them and not the Philippines? Well, I remember reading some arguments in the Senate debates anyway, that because we can see them as being a little more civilized and potentially becoming eventually American citizens, right? Whereas Filipinos, no, I mean, not to mention that the idea of a Filipino race is largely invented at the time, right? So you're really talking about lots and lots and lots of peoples on lots and lots of islands. But anyway, I'm digressing.
Go ahead, Jason.
No, I was just going to say that's an important point. I mean, those racial arguments in defense of imperialism, right? You get those arguments from McKinley, especially the Beveridges there in the Senate. I don't see, at least in these documents, Brian, talking about race. In fact, you don't need to make a racial argument in order to make an argument against imperialism. What Brian is saying throughout this speech is, no, you look at the Declaration of Independence, and if we accept the Declaration of Independence and the equal natural rights of all human beings, that applies to the Filipinos as it does to every other race throughout the world, which is why he'll say, we cannot repudiate the principle of self-government in the Philippines without weakening that principle here. If we don't defend the right of the Filipinos to govern themselves, we cannot defend our own right to govern ourselves. It's the progressives, it's the imperialists who are making that racial argument. Brian, doesn't get into that. For him, it's, well, let's go back to the Declaration.
Yeah. John, did you want to jump in? I had a question, but go ahead.
On paragraph 51, he says, if the Puerto Ricans who welcomed annexation are to be denied the guarantees of our Constitution, what is to be the lot of the Filipinos who resisted? It's just a throwaway line, but yeah, we can treat the Puerto Rico differently because they welcomed our annexation. Filipinos are and the Filipinos are willing to fight against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
Not sure what he means by that, but
okay. Yeah, I don't know if he's talking about like that. Well, we have the consent of the Puerto Ricans, and that's what makes it okay. And since we don't have the consent of the Filipinos, that's what makes it not okay. Maybe something along those lines.
Well, it also might mean, at least as Candy points out in her comment, that we don't need to put together an army for Puerto Rico.
Right. No, that's an important point for Brian. We're going to have
Brian.
The military is just going to expand and explode if you want to keep the Philippines.
Yeah, because he does make a point in his anti-imperialism speech about the need to not sort of waste American lives on things, right? Which I thought was an interesting point too. So didn't quite put it as eloquently as he did. But did you see evidence in his anti-imperialism of his religiosity too? I mean, we mentioned Albert Beveridge earlier, and he gives these soaring rhetorical speeches about, you know, we've got to help these people. And we know Beveridge grounds that on certain religious ideas or religious terms at times, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't see it in his speech, but do you think his religious views influenced his views of on imperialism? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. If you don't know, it's fine. But
yeah, well, yeah, he thinks that the religious argument is bunk, right? What does he says? He says on 99 going forward, 100. If true Christianity consists in carrying out in our daily lives the teachings of Christ, who will say that we are commanded to civilize with dynamite and proselyte with the sword?
Well, that's a great point.
Yeah. He who would declare the divine will must prove his authority either by holy writ or by evidence of a special dispensation. The command, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, has no Gatling gun attachment.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. When Jesus visited a village of Samaria and the people refused to receive him, some of the disciples suggested that fire should be called down from heaven to avenge the insult. But the man hit them and said, ye know not what manner of spirit ye are from, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Suppose he had said, we will thrash them until they understand who we are. How different would that would have been the history of Christianity?
That's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's perfect. Thanks, John. Perfect lines. So, yeah, this is, again, we're kind of coming to the end of our time here quickly. Unfortunately, this is just always flies by. But we mentioned earlier Brian's religious views, his Protestantism. Mm-hmm. I had a question. Do we know, he was not affiliated with the social gospel at all? Do we know? Right? Or
we keep him separate?
I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I don't think he was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But he became famous, as we know, not became famous, but was back in the public spotlight again over the Scopes trials, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody had asked earlier, trying to find out here quickly, who was that that asked this? I can tell you really quickly. Ann asked whether part of the reason Brian went all, she says he went all fundamentalist preacher mode in the Scopes trial, and wanted to know, was that in part an attempt to become relevant in politics again, or was this really tied sincerely to his religious views on these things? Can we talk a little bit about his role in these things, because this is sort of the last big thing he's known for?
I'm fascinated by the Stokes trial. By the way, about the social gospel, the social gospel supporters were all religious modernists.
Mm.
They were not fundamentalists.
I gotcha. Right. Okay.
And so that always would really have kept them out of the social. And I don't see in Brian's rhetoric some idea of preparing the way for the kingdom of God or bringing up the kingdom of God on earth. That doesn't
gotcha
in Brian's words.
Gotcha. Okay, good.
Yes, he was motivated by his fundamentalist beliefs, but what also often gets overlooked in the Scopes trial is to what extent it was about the right of a community to determine what its children learn. For Brian, that was at least as important as the religious aspect. he didn't like the idea. And this, again, shows how he is not the same as the progressives, right? The progressives would have said, well, of course, you know, we want good science. We want good science to be taught everywhere. For Brian, this is a matter of a community that holds strong religious beliefs, mm-hmm. wants to pass those beliefs on to its children. They should have the say over what goes on in its public schools.
That's a great point, John. And that's kind of a nice exclamation point on Brian's life, because it shows a real consistency in his way of thinking about the role of the individual and local communities versus national centralization, standardization, all of these sorts of things. That's a really nice point. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and it's not a, if I could just piggyback on that,
please, yeah.
Brian's role in the Scopes trial is not, and Brian never understood it as an anti-scientific position or an anti-scientific role. Right. Brian sort of said, yeah, science has its place. What's the famous line that it's science can make great material improvements for mankind, something along these lines, but it is not a appropriate teacher of morals. Sort of going back to what John was talking about, you know, how to pass on that moral fabric to the next generation. Brian would say you can't do that through science. That's why you need religion. And if a community decides to teach religion in public schools, that is their right.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, really well put. Well, guys, appreciate it. We've come to the end of our time. It's been really eye-opening for me, especially since I profess I knew relatively little about Brian. Do you have recommendations for books for people to read on Brian? Hey, John, you ever read any good books on the Gilded Age? Populism.
There's a book I enjoyed. Michael Kazin, K-A-Z-I-N, mm-hmm. wrote a book called The Populist Persuasion, which is really a broad history of populism throughout American history, but obviously there's a huge chunk dedicated to this period. He also has probably the best biography of William Jennings Bryan called A Godless. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Let me mention two other things. I recommend two other things. If you're at all interested in H.L. Mencken, I love reading Mencken stuff. Mencken's obituary of William Jennings Bryan is so savage and so witty. I recommend, just do it. You can find it online. But H.L. Mencken's obituary, one of his famous line is, "Imagine a gentleman and you will have everything he was not."
Wow.
One more thing. I want to put in a plug. This summer in the MAG program, I'm teaching our progressive era course. And we'll be spending some time on Brian in that. And in fact, we'll be using a game on designing a role-playing game about the election of 1912. Somebody will actually play the role of William Jennings Bryan.
Nice. That's awesome. Good. Mm. All right. Well, look forward to that. Hopefully, if anybody's interested, they'll look into your course and sign up for that. So, well, great. Thank you very much, both of you. Really, really enjoyed our time together, and hope you guys have a great weekend. Thanks again for your time and your minds.
Thanks.
This is enlightening.
This was great. Yeah. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, guys. And hope everybody else who joined us enjoyed this and found it thoughtful. Thanks for some great questions. It really moved the conversation along in some thoughtful directions. Just a reminder quickly about the email that you'll receive with your link to a certificate of participation. Sorry. And again, if you've enjoyed our webinar today, look into the other resources that Ashbrook provides, including our MAG courses and a lot of free one-day seminars, which we hold in over 20 states. These are all discussion-based. Centered on original documents. Take a look at the TAH.org website and click on seminars and find some more information about these free one-day seminars around the country. And if you've enjoyed today's program, help us spread the word about these things by posting something in your social media, right? We'd greatly appreciate that. Our next Saturday webinar will be March 7th, and we'll be talking about Jane Addams, another person from relatively the same era. So that should be fun as well. Until then, take care, and I hope to see you at the next webinar. Thanks.
Thanks again for listening. Remember that you can find information about all of our programs online and in person at tah.org. If you look in the upper right-hand corner of the home screen, you'll see a link to our seminars, where you can find out information about our live free seminars for teachers of American history, government, and civics that we're holding in about 25 states at this point. And also under the programs link on at the top of that homepage, you can find information about both our webinar series, Documents in Detail, and this year's Saturday webinar series, American Minds. Our next Documents in Detail webinar, as Dr. Stevens said, is on the 19th of February of this year and will be on Plessy v. Ferguson. Thanks so much.